of a different kind of society than today. Having spent, you know, as a young man, 4 years out in the world prior to World War II, if you were an officer in the services, for example, or in my case, the Navy, it didn't matter how young you were a member of the club, as it were. You belonged, and there was a free exchange, I think, between a junior and a senior officers, perhaps to a greater degree than today.
That's been my experience. I want to get some of the newer admirals, like Bob Yano, because he grew up properly, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
He came in as a sea cadet and served in the Navy that you and I belonged to for many years before he had to transfer to the hated Green. I think that spirit still lives today. It certainly does in Yano, feels that way, and I know Brodeur does, and they're the only two admirals I know today.
Yes.
You served with Yano, I think?
Yes, I knew Yano and Brodeur. When from 1961 to 63, I was in command of the 5th Canadian Escort Squadron, which consisted of 7 quite new ships then, of the Restigouche class, and Brodeur and Yano were both weapons officers in 2 of the ships in the squadron. Brodeur was in the Kootenay, and I can't for the life of me remember which ship that Yano was in.
What were they like as young officers?
They were impressed. I thought I saw more of Brodeur, and I thought he was certainly going places. He seemed a very able young fellow.
Mm-hmm. You're in the training cruiser. No other Canadians there.
Except in our class, that's all.
But foreign officers, did you have many foreign officers?
Well, we had a few Indians, Asiatic Indians, in the newly formed Royal Indian Navy, and we had, surprisingly, about 10 or so Chinese. Whatever happened to them and the various revolutions since, I don't know. But they joined in the spirit of things and were good shipmates to have. And I imagine they were probably a superior bunch, because after all they had to learn English before they could even take on such a thing. And they were perfectly competitive with the other cadets.
And Marjo doesn't stick in your mind particularly.
Yeah,
sure does in Welland and Hennessy.
Yes, well, he was new. You see, they were a year after me, and the Marjo, I guess, was probably, I think we only had him for the last of the 3 cruisers, and so I remember his predecessor better. Yeah. But Marjo certainly he was a good, energetic fellow, and certainly, you know, took the greatest interest in his duties.
And he was rough on you?
Not particularly. They were, you know, everything was fairly pretty strict there, and of necessity. I mean, that was the,
yeah.
And you weren't even allowed ashore after, I think it was about 7 o'clock, 1900, unless you had an invitation to go to somebody's house. So when you got ashore, the first thing you did was to try and cultivate the acquaintance of somebody wherever you were, and said, "Would you please give me an invitation to dinner? I won't necessarily come, but that gives me an excuse to you don't have to entertain me. That gives us an excuse to stay ashore."
I'm sure you phrase it better than that. Anything else about your training cruiser time?
No, well, I think it was the best thing about that was that it gave you a sea time. You know, there's no way you can fight wars at sea unless you're accustomed to living on the sea. I don't have to tell by interviewer that, but perhaps others wouldn't realize it. And it's, after all, if you're a hockey player, you don't think about skating. If you're playing water polo, you don't think about swimming. Those things come naturally. So the first thing for a good naval officer is to be completely at home and out on the oceans aboard ship, and then you take it from there.
And you also did the work of the seamen, so you knew what that was like.
Yes, and we did the work of the seamen, and as a result, we're close to the men, and that was invaluable. Perhaps of even greater value to our British shipmates than the Canadians, because after all, we were dealing with a different, as officers to be, we would be dealing with a somewhat different kind of person. But even so, it was a good experience.
There's been some criticism leveled at officers of your generation that, having done cadet's time in a training cruiser, midshipman's time in a battleship or a cruiser, having done their sub-lieutenant's courses and then gone back to sea as an acting sub, having gone to sea as an acting sub-lieutenant and then being confirmed, they spent 5 years away from home. But it wasn't a good thing for a Canadian officer to be that long away from the Canadian scene, and therefore when they got back they didn't treated the Canadian sailors the same way as they seen the RN officers treat the RN sailors, and they weren't the same kind of sailors at all. You've heard that.
Oh, I've often heard that, and without question there's a strong vein of truth in it. It affected some people more than it affected others, but what was the alternative? We had no naval college of our own, as we've just been chatting about, I don't think the British particularly wanted to train us, but nobody else. We couldn't train our own officers. We in those days, while we vaunted our political independence, we were really a military colony still of Great Britain, and they provided all our military training, tradition, and background, and so forth. It was unfortunate but true, and there was, under the circumstances, under the political circumstances in Canada, where they did not want to wish to spend money on the armed forces and would tolerate their future naval officers being trained by somebody else, it's a surprising thing that it worked out as well as it did.
Well, the ones that just popped to my mind, they never got la-di-da. There's you, there's Bob Welland, there's Ralph Hennessy, there's Mickey Sterling. Yeah. Ricky Sterling might have had a handkerchief up his sleeve and a monocle in his eye and a handkerchief out of his breast pocket, but I mean, he was a Canadian still.
Yeah.
Bob Murdoch is funny about that, you know. He says that when he came home and said, "Hello, mater," he got a cuff from his father, I think he said.
I remember being teased for having an English accent by my own brothers when I reappeared in the county. After all, we went away, in my case, for 4 years, and during those 4 years, we only came back once for leave, for about a month or so, and otherwise we were out of the country the whole time.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you one way, this would seem strange today. When we were midshipmen, I was in a British cruiser called the Exeter, and we spent most of our time in South America for the best part of 2 years. We went to Bermuda for the annual exercises, and otherwise we were in South American countries. And there was only one other Canadian in the ship, John Ansley, my classmate. And in South America in those days, there were no Canadian embassies anywhere at all. There was a trade commissioner in Lima, Peru, and another one in Buenos Aires, the capital of Argentina. But the British ambassadors or ministers in the small countries with legations, they represented Canada. They'd never been to Canada. They knew nothing about Canada. But again, because Canada hadn't bestirred itself into asserting its or paying for its sovereignty, and they found that there were two Canadians in the ship. They perked up, you see, and they said, "My God, we must do something about them." And I remember the British minister in in Lima was a charming fellow married to a De Beers diamond heiress, and he had John Annesley and me to for the weekend in the legation, and we had a great time, and then we got on down the coast to Santiago, the capital of Chile, and the British ambassador there, there was a huge ball with all the bigwigs of Chile, I think everybody but the President of the Republic himself and many ambassadors, and Sir Hugo Bentinck, I think, was the name of the British ambassador. Remember,
B-E-N-T-I-C-K? Bentinck, Sir Hugh?
Yes, that's right. Anyway, he drew me aside right in the middle of this great party, but nothing served but champagne and everybody in the most formal clothes of those days. And he said to me, Mr. Nixon, I'm very sorry that I wasn't able to have a Mr. Jorge or George Nixon, a barrister in Valparaiso, to the ball. I invited him, but he wasn't able to come. But I'm going to put you in touch with him, because I think you'd like to meet him, and you may even be some distant relation, which in fact we were. In both cases, I put this down to the guilty conscience of these senior British officials who were supposed to represent Canada, as I say, a country they knew nothing about.
That's an interesting sidelight on how Canada was riding on the coattails of Great Britain.
That's
long
right.
After
yes.
She said
yeah.
She was
yeah.
Independent.
That's right, not only from the military point of view, also the diplomatic point of view.
Yeah, that's a good point. Dr. Douglas would be pleased to get that point of view. It's not come out in a previous interview. You were in Exeter to do your midshipman's time.
Yes.
2 years.
2 years. And
what else about the South America station then? It's the West Indies and South America station. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it was called the America and West Indies station, but they had two cruisers of the five or six they had at the time there were detached and called the South America Division. And our captain was a commodore, because if you're a commodore, you could be received by the presidents of the republics of the different countries. You were high enough up to pay a personal call on the president. And while during that period, this is from 36 to 38, the British were falling over backwards to create good relations with South America. There were tremendous British investments in the country. In Buenos Aires, for example, there were 75,000 British subjects, almost a city within a city, and they controlled the railways and the banks and the department stores and so forth. But the British had developed a very bad name in the 1920s, because it was a British cruiser. The flagship of the West Indies was in Buenos Aires, and the Admiral called on the President of the Republic of this important country, very comparable to Canada, with a slightly greater population, and the President said that he would like to do them the honor of visiting their flagship. But in the interval between this announcement and his actual arrival, the Admiral was invited to go fishing, and he went. Then the next thing that happened, the captain was asked to go hunting or something, and he went, and the president arrived and was received by the executive officer of the ship, was naturally the Argentines are proud and haughty people, and he was so infuriated at this insulting reception that they wouldn't allow a British ship in the country for several years afterwards. And so by the time I got on the scene, everything was trying to be done to soothe the pride of these countries and try to re-establish good relations.
That's a dreadful thing just told me.
But it reflects on the tremendous arrogance of the British at the time. They felt they were lords of the earth, even though you could say it was late afternoon of the British Empire, but the sun was still shining, and they thought they were perhaps bigger cheeses than they really were.
There's a terrible tendency among England, the wogs start at Calais.
That's right.
You know that point of view? And anybody can understand English if you speak slowly enough and loudly enough. Yes. They don't take any trouble to learn other other languages. That's a terrible thing.
Well, it would be unimaginable today, but that just shows how in the gilded days of the Raj, that was the sort of thing that they could do.
The usual midshipman's training?
Yes, and we did one cruise of 9 months, spending in those stately days. We'd spend a week in the smaller places, and 2 weeks in the capital cities, the ports of capital cities, much longer than ships would ever visit anywhere today. And you, by the time you left, you were old friends of people and writing letters back and forth for weeks or months afterwards. And it became a bit strenuous for the midshipmen, because we, of course, had to go about our daily duties of running boats and keeping watch and worst of all, doing early morning physical training with some muscle-bound petty officer in charge, and sometimes we'd only been in our hammocks for about an hour or two after coming back for some ball in one of these countries, and as you know, the Spanish hours, a dance often wouldn't start till midnight and would go on until all hours. And so I remember even at the age of 19 you felt a bit, the physique sagged a bit sometimes when you were supposed to do setting up exercises after being dancing most of the night. But I have one thing that happened to me in Buenos Aires that it's never happened to me before. Since we went to, we had dinner, I think, at some British officials, I think he was the counselor of the embassy, and then we went on to a dance at the British embassy, and my girl I was paired off with must have been of local prominence, because the next morning I picked up the Buenos Aires Herald, the English language paper, and there was a drawing of her and describing her gown for the evening.
So young Nixon has made the social scene. I once made the social scene in Tatler. You remember what a snobbish thing Tatler was? It said, "Lady the so-and-so, so-and-so, the Right Honorable so-and-so, the Right Honorable so-and-so." And my girl was an honorable so-and-so, and then it said, "And escort." Didn't bother with my name.
Yes. No, well, the only time we appeared unnamed in the Buenos Aires Herald was in white flannels on the quarterdeck doing our press-ups after one of these bloody dances.
Was there any... high feeling between the darts and the public school entries?
Well, there was I don't think there was too much feeling between the cadets themselves, but the officers, or rather the men, I would say, more than the officers, the warrant officers and petty officers and so forth, preferred the special entry, the public school entry cadets, because they were new and enthusiastic, whereas they felt that the Dartmouth cadets, who'd already been in the Navy, in a manner of speaking, for 4 years, were a bit sort of blasé and had a rather sort of studied disinterest about things as the way the officers turned out, I don't think there was much to choose between them, but they were a year younger than you. They were a little bit younger, not maybe a year, 6 months or a year younger. But being biased, even though, as I mentioned, my father joined the Navy at the age of about 13 or 14, and many prominent British naval officers did the same thing, including Mountbatten. It seemed to me it would be a bit of a gamble for somebody to be in the right niche to join so young before had really any much of a chance to make up their mind. If you're, you know, the difference between joining at 13 and joining at 17 is very great in a boy.
I think the Dart entries got a lot of people in the service that, as time went on, they decided they weren't really for the service, but what else was there to do now?
That's right.
Whereas our chaps had made more of a, had more of a choice.
Yes, when they came to, they were in the Navy and always had been, and didn't quite know why. Something.
And didn't know how to go about doing anything else, yes.
Yeah.
Your seamanship examination was the big thing at the end of your midshipman's time.
Yes. Yes, we... And that was all done on by interview,
yeah.
And they had a captain of one of the ships and the commander, the executive officers of two of the other ships, and they also it also included signals. So they had the flag lieutenant, the only qualified, as we would say, communications officer, or operations officer, yeah. I guess today, be the right word. So he was also on the interviewing board.
Was there anything besides showing the flag? Did you do shoots, fire your torpedoes?
Oh yes, we did exercises, and we there was a place called Punta del Este, which is a suburb of Montevideo, the capital of Uruguay, in the River Plate.
E-S-T, Punta...
East Point, yeah.
E-S-T-A, then.
Yeah, yes.
Yeah.
Punta D-E-L, E-S-T-E.
E-S-T-E, yeah.
And that was like a small British naval base, because they had Uruguayan tug to tow targets, and Uruguayan naval tug, and Uruguayan naval liaison officers, and we did quite a lot of exercises there. But our big exercises were off Bermuda when we joined up with the rest of the squadron.
What was the size of the whole squadron then? You mentioned, I think, six cruisers.
Yes, either five or six cruisers, perhaps five at any one time, and they also had at least two sloops. You remember sloops, the slow speed escort vessels.
Yeah. No destroyers, I think.
No. The Canadian destroyers would join up for their winter exercises.
Do you remember at all how the Canadian destroyers measured up when they came down there for exercises?
As I recall, they did well. And sometimes they would have the British home fleet would go on a Caribbean cruise in the winter, of course, and the Canadian destroyers would join up with, you know, what was a much larger real fleet with battleships and cruisers, destroyers, aircraft carriers, and that gave them a real chance to, yeah, to get on a, you know, more complicated maneuvers.
Must be sort of an old home week for you with the Canadian destroyers,
yeah,
to visit.
Yes, I think four Canadian destroyers appeared, and the two from either coast, it was quite a brief time that we saw them. We didn't see very much of them.
You then went to subs courses,
lieutenant's courses which were all in Portsmouth at that time. Officers a few years, or maybe only a couple of years before me, they spent some time at the Royal Naval College in Greenwich outside London as well. But we did all our courses in Portsmouth, and we of course were perfect cannon fodder, because we just completed our 4 years training in time in the summer of 1939, with the 6 year war coming along. And in looking back on it, I always feel that was our greatest usefulness in the war was the fully trained watchkeeping officers at the beginning of the war, when such articles were very scarce. And even though, like most of my contemporaries here, I got a command later in the war, but by that time there were many people to choose from, and who'd had the war had been going on for 4 years by that time, and there were lots of, but I think to be a fully trained young officer, commissioned officer as a sub-lieutenant right at the beginning of the war was good. And but the tragic result was, of course, there were very many casualties, because most of our contemporaries spent practically the whole war at sea, and of our gunroom, our midshipmen, sub-lieutenants' mess in the Exeter, half of them were killed in the war. But the another thing was, here we were poised for the Battle of the Atlantic fighting U-boats, and there was one thing that was not included in our training, it seems strange to believe, was any course in anti-submarine warfare. And so my classmate David Groose and I, the only other executive officer, John Annesley, he got held up either through sickness or failing an exam or something. He got delayed in finishing his course. He had to do part of one again. Anyway, so, but the two of us, we thought, we knew we were going to destroyers, equipped with what we would call sonar today, and we knew nothing about it. So we asked to apply it, and were given a course of 2 or 3 weeks in Portland, where they had an anti-submarine school, and that was of the greatest usefulness to us, because when I then went to Canada and in August 1939 joined my first Canadian ship, this destroyer Saloron in Comox, I was the only person who had any anti-submarine training at all, only officer of the ship.
Let's talk about Saloron then.
Well, that ship I spent 3 years in. the first year as a junior officer, and then the second 2 years everybody started leaving, and I was the second in command. I spent the second 2 years as the executive officer, the number one of the ship.
Who was your first captain?
The first captain was Adrian Hope, Boomer Hope.
Yeah.
And he was there for just from Comox we went to Vancouver for the opening of the Pacific National Exhibition, and we landed. We had three destroyers. We landed a company to march in the parade for the opening of the exhibition. The company commander was the first lieutenant of the Fraser, Lieutenant Commander Pat Tisdall. The company's second in command was the Captain D's staff officer, the platoon navigator John Stubbs. The three platoon commanders, need I say it, were the three junior officers of the ship. Larry Rutherford was in command of one, Eric Boke was in command of another, and I was in command of the third. For many years now, I've been the only survivor of that merry band. But then while we were at Vancouver, we were told to proceed to Halifax with all dispatch, when we got down off the west coast of Mexico, the war broke out, and we received a difficult order, which in words to the effect, do not provoke action, but return fire if attacked. because Canada had not declared war until a week later, as everybody perhaps will be aware, they had to summon Parliament, and the members of Parliament had to get there by train, and it took a week for them to reassemble and pass the vote for the declaration of war. And then we eventually refueled, and I think in San Pedro, California, and Panama, and then also in Jamaica, and then round Halifax.
Anything interesting about that passage? Did you make it in good time?
I think it was about the fastest passage time, and there were just two ships involved in that, the Fraser and the Saloron. Mm. And incidentally, between Jamaica and Halifax, we lost each other. Of course, there was no radar in those days, and we were going along through the night, or there was foggy or whatever, but anyway, we arrived. arrived in Halifax, but they weren't even together, the two ships. And the other two ships, the Ottawa and the rest of them, came around a little bit later.
Yeah.
But we arrived in Halifax and refueled and went straight out to sea again to escort the first transatlantic convoy, HX-1, out of Halifax. And we spent from September 39 until May 1940 doing just that. We would take the ships out about 500 miles or so and then return to Halifax. Against German heavy surface raiders, there were a mixture of British and French naval ships to provide the heavy surface escort, and of course destroyers provided the anti-submarine escort. And we started out by doing a thing that was eventually realized it was so dangerous for a marine accident, a collision, that they stopped it. But they had the convoy doing a zigzag, and then they had the two destroyers on either wing of the convoy doing a zigzag superimposed on the convoy zigzag. So as you could see on a dark night with no radar, you could be in big trouble, but or collision. But and I remember Sub-Lieutenant Nixon went up at midnight to take over the watch from the first lieutenant, Fred Grubb. He said just what I've been saying, that we were doing a zigzag on the starboard wing of the convoy, and the convoy was also zigzagging, and so I said, "What are we doing now?" And he said, "Well, we're on the way in towards the convoy." And I said, "Well, when is it? It would be a good time to."